Well, okay, welcome over. Sorry, just came from Staten Island. I literally just walked into the house. So let me see. I'm a little out of breath. We are talking about kashrus, soul food, tonight. And I wanted to talk a bit about the idea of what, first of all, let me start with what the idea of a tam hamitzvah is. We talk about the meaning of a law. Like, we use the term tam hamitzvah, a reason for the commandment. The truth is, in Hebrew, the term that we use for reason is sibah or ilah. Sibah or ilah. Now, here, when it comes to tamei hamitzvahs, the reason for commandments, the terminology used is tam. Now, what do we mean by that? So Rav Dessler explained in the following way. Rav Dessler says, what we mean by tam hamitzvah, the word tam actually means taste. So he said in Yiddish, das meant the geschmackkeit from the mitzvah, the taste of the mitzvah. So he explained it in the following way, that we cannot really know ultimately why Hashem commands something. In other words, to get into the mind of Hashem, which is infinite and all-powerful and all-knowing, is not possible for a finite human being. As Solomon ibn Gvirol said in one of his poems, Ilu yidativ hayitiv, if I'd know him, I'd be him. So we can't get to that level where we know. However, we can know that there are. What is the impact of the mitzvah? What is the effect of the mitzvah? What is the taste of the mitzvah? So when I eat food, the reason I'm eating food, ostensibly, it should be at least, the reason I eat food is in order to survive. Right? In order to survive. However, right, there are pleasant side benefits to eating food. There is taste, there is aroma, there is texture, there is appearance. There are many pleasant side benefits. So in the same way, when it comes to a mitzvah, we have to understand that ultimately the reason I'm doing the mitzvah is because God has the right to command me to do so. And that's why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because Hashem said to do so. That is the motivation to do it. That's the authority to do it. So the authority of the mitzvah doesn't require that I understand it. In the same way, for example, as it doesn't gravity, if I trip, God forbid, then I will accelerate at 9.8 meters per second squared, whether I understand gravity or not. Now, even if I think gravity is like they used to think of force, I don't really understand it as the curvature of space-time or whatever, right? The fact that I don't understand it will not mean that I'll fall any slower, and it will not mean that I won't fall. The law is the law, and it will remain that way independent of my understanding. So the same is true when we come to the mitzvahs. The law is the law, independent of my understanding. However, that's only in terms of understanding the why. Why it was commanded, I don't know that. What I can know, however, is what is the taste or the side benefit or the effect of the mitzvah. So, for example, when you look in the Rambam in the third section of Moreh HaNevuchim, the Rambam has extensive discussion about reasons for mitzvahs. But there he, for instance, talks about Shabbos as a time of leisure, a time of relaxation. And he says that even the wealthiest person, the greatest politician, the great leaders, they could never expect to have a seventh of their life in calm and in calm leisure and happiness without having to think about economics or politics or the military, etc., etc. He says, yet every Jew can have that. Now, clearly, we know that that's not the reason for Shabbos. I mean, it's mentioned in the Torah that it's Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim, that it's Zeichel Maisa Bereishis, etc., etc. What the Rambam is saying is, this is one of the great impacts of Shabbos. One of the great side effects of Shabbos is that it gives us this type of leisure, this type of calm, this type of meditative possibility, etc. So in the same token, when we talk about kashrus, we have the same idea. We may mention reasons for kashrus, ideas behind kashrus, but when we mention them, we understand them as being benefits of kashrus as opposed to the reason. So tam hamitzvah doesn't mean the cause of a mitzvah, it means the effect of a mitzvah. And that's a very, very important distinction philosophically, a very important distinction, because if we begin to believe that the reasons that we come up with for a mitzvah are not just the effect, but they're the cause of the mitzvah, then a person might be tempted to say, well, if that's the cause of the mitzvah, then if I can figure out another way to do it, or if I can figure out a way to avoid the damage caused by this sin, independent of the Torah, then that should be okay, because but it's not that. And that's where the mistake, is made by many people. The people who, for instance, maintain that there have been anthropologists who've spoken about kashrus as being a superstitious taboo or as a eating habits and norms of the ancient Near East. There's an author who explained the laws of kashrus as being who was that? Was Marvin Harris in The Sacred Cow and the Abominable Pig, who explained the laws of kashrus as being economic. You've got all types of explanations. Like, for example, the famous or infamous explanation that the reason the Torah prohibited ham is because of the trichinosis, which is the common name applied to a disease of rats, warts, and swine, etc., which is caused by an infection of a larvae of a nematode worm called the trichina worm. But obviously, if you think that's the reason for the mitzvah, then a person might say, well, you know what, if you cook it well or you refrigerate it well, then there's no problem with trichinosis, so goodbye, you know, goodbye to the mitzvah. But clearly, as Reb Destler is saying, that's not what we mean when we say this is a tam ha-mitzvah. What we really mean is it's an effect of the mitzvah. And since it's an effect of the mitzvah, then I cannot modify the mitzvah or dismiss the mitzvah because of my particular understanding, because it's only an effect, it's not the cause. I hope that's clear to everyone. It's a very important introduction before we get into what I call the tamei ha-mitzvahs of kashrus. Okay. Another point about kashrus is that the terminology the Torah uses for kosher food is interesting terminology. It refers to it as tahor, and non-kosher food is referred to as tamei. Tahor and tamei. Now, the words tahor and tamei are used in the Torah as concepts of purity and impurity when it discusses, for example, sexual ethics, idolatry, and many other areas. You know, it doesn't refer to it as dirty. It doesn't refer to it as unhealthy. And the Torah doesn't give explicit reasons, but it does say that it's a matter of tumah and tahara. The category in which most Jewish scholars have placed kashrus is usually in the category which we call chukim. Chukim. And a chok is something which is a... the word chok comes from the word lachkok, which means to inscribe. It's something which is inscribed in the very nature of reality. And so that's what a chok is. A chok is something inscribed in the nature of reality. And that's basically what the laws of kashrus are. They are a reality. So one idea behind kashrus is the concept of a chok. And it's interesting, the Rambam says, he quotes this in his introduction to Pirkei Avos, his commentary on Pirkei Avos is known as Shmoina Prakim. So in the sixth perek of that, the Rambam quotes a fascinating statement by Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, a person should not say, I can't stand meat and milk. A person should not say, I can't stand ham. A person should say, I would like it. It looks good, it smells good. My students tell me it tastes good. Right? A person should say, I'd like it, but I don't have it because Hashem said not to. So the Rambam understands that what that is saying here is that in the laws which are called chukim, they are designed to elicit from us a level of humility and a level of obedience to Hashem's law. They're not the type of things that we are going to necessarily understand completely, but they're the type of thing which are necessary because certain laws have got to be beyond our understanding for the simple reason that, let's imagine if we understood every law. So then basically what we're saying is, I'm not obedient to Hashem, I'm not a servant of God. Basically, God's lucky that I happen to agree with him 613 times. You know, God gave me the Torah and I say, hey, you know what, that makes sense and that makes sense and that. So the whole thing makes sense. So therefore, if everything makes sense to me totally, then who am I serving? I'm basically a servant of my own sense as opposed to someone who is a servant of God. And it's important to have that level of humility and to be a servant to Hashem because morality requires humility. Morality requires that certain things just be beyond me and above me so that I'm not the ultimate adjudicator of what is correct and what is not correct. That's a major point that I think we have to mention when we talk about kashrus. Now let's get to, having said those introductory remarks, let's get to what I call the rationale of the laws or the tamei ha-mitzvahs. The first and most obvious is character modification. That is to say, the laws of kashrus modify the character. The most general way it does that is by imposing self-control. Eating is one of the most instinctive things you can do. I mean, you know, breathing, obviously, but there's not much more instinctive than eating. And yet, And yet you've got these halachas about eating, and a lot of the people in the world don't understand that. But it's incredibly important. You know, the fact that I can exercise self-control, the fact that I'm at an airport somewhere and there's nothing, and I can't find anything kosher to eat, so I decide, okay, fine, I'll just have a drink, right? And I'll be hungry a little bit, etc. Is something which a lot of people find incomprehensible, because in the Western world. You know, when you tell someone something is not acceptable, in other words, you say the word no, N-O, people think that means don't do it publicly, take precautions, stop after a few, don't get addicted, I won't get caught. But the idea that no means actually don't do this at all, don't eat this at all ever, is incomprehensible. But of course, we know that one of the most important things a person needs, one of the most important capacities or strengths that a person needs to succeed in every area of life, especially in the moral and spiritual areas, is self-control. So kashrut, more than anything else, is just a classic example of the idea of self-control. And actually, on that statement of Rosh Hashanah Gamliel, which says a person shouldn't say it's disgusting, right? You shouldn't say, oh, it's disgusting. But you should say, it looks good, but I don't have it because Hashem said not to. Because you see, if we brainwash our children or educate them to believe that it's disgusting and it tastes horrible, then when they don't eat it, it's not a matter of self-control. They're not exercising self-control in not eating the trace. That's not self-control. If I see something disgusting and don't eat it, there's no self-control in that. If I see something delicious and don't eat it, that is self-control. So that's, I think, what the point that the Rambam seems to be making here. That's a general idea behind all of kashrus, which is just the concept of self-control and the concept of consciousness versus instinct. That's to say that you know, some people call it mindfulness. That when you do something like eating, for example, it's good to be mindful, to be conscious of what I'm doing, not to be just doing it like an animal who, you know, you put the bowl down with the food and my dog, you know, is going to put his head into the bowl and it's not going to come out of the bowl until it's licked clean on a molecular level, right? But anyway, but the idea here is that the human being should be above that and should not do things purely by instinct, but should do things through consciousness and decision-making. So the most obvious aspect of kashrus, I would say, is the fact that it makes us a decision-maker. It makes me conscious and mindful as opposed to mindless and instinctive and going on autopilot. So any time a Jew eats, they've got to go through a number of, you know, questions in their mind. You know, is it kosher? Is it not kosher? Has it been supervised correctly? Has it been left out in the open? You know, have I had meat recently? Can I now? Is this dairy? Is it not dairy? What brocha do I make, etc.? That's all an amazing thing, because what it means is that I'm not just giving in to pure instinct, I'm exercising some control over myself. That's what I would say is a number one and very, very general. Number two in terms of character modification is the idea of compassion. And the Rambam says this, that shchita, the idea of shchita is that the animal has to be, even though the animal, we're allowed to use animals, we're allowed to eat animals, we're allowed to kill animals, but we have to recognize that animals are not automatons who are devoid of feelings of pain. Animals have physical pain. They can even experience emotional pain, because he says emotional pain is not a exercise of intelligence. It's a matter of the imagination and the instinct. And if that's true, which certainly is, then animals can experience pain. So when we use an animal, we have to recognize and have compassion upon that creature. Why? Because I become a more compassionate person by recognizing that I need to have compassion upon those creatures who are beneath me. So the idea of shchita, that the animal is killed, first of all, not by anyone, but only by an expert. Right? And the animal is killed not in the course of a hunt, because you can't really hunt an animal and make it kosher at the same time. It's almost, I mean, I guess the Gemara does say of a certain tana who was able to check an arrow and could check the bird in mid-flight with an arrow. So unless you're some type of hugely advanced martial arts expert, right, it's not going to be possible. Right? So that means it precludes hunting. It means also that not every Tom, Dick, and Harry is going to be killing animals in their backyard. It means it's going to be limited to certain experts. Right? It's going to be done with a blessing before you do it. It's going to be, in certain animals, you're going to cover the blood as a sign of respect. Right? The shchita knife has to be absolutely sharp. It has to be without any nicks. and that's tested on the shochet, on the slaughterer's fingernail to simulate animal cartilage, and it's tested on his skin to simulate animal skin, so that if he feels a nick, the animal will feel a nick. So that it's done by cutting the trachea, the esophagus, the carotid artery and the jugular vein are cut. There's almost a complete loss of consciousness almost immediately to the animal. If the brain's the blood pressure in the brain goes down to almost zero almost immediately, and the corneal reflexes stop after a few seconds. So it's the purpose of shchita ultimately, the way the Rambam sees it and others, is to actually to kill the animal, but to kill it in a way that gives it the least possible pain and limits it to only certain people doing it. I'm always amazed. There was a politician, an American politician, who promised a kinder, gentler America. And I remember reading an interview with him in a magazine. And the interview was conducted while he was hunting grouse, type of bird, on his estate. So I saw that interview. I said, like, what a contradiction. How can someone be espousing a kinder, gentler America while he's sitting there with a shotgun, right, hunting birds? And it's not like he needed the birds in order to survive. You know, it wasn't like a subsistence farmer, right? He was hunting for sport. So, you know, in fact, the Noida the Yehuda, Rabbi Chezkel Landau, in a very, very famous tshuva, was asked by a Jew if he could, the Jew wanted to know if he could go hunting to entertain some non-Jewish business partners. So is he allowed to go hunting? So the Noida the Yehuda, this is, I can give you the reference if anyone wants to look it up, but It's Noda Yehuda Yoradea Madura Kama Siman Yud. So it's Yoradea 110. So to get back to Noda Yehuda, what he says is, I'm shocked by the activity of hunting for sport. Only hunters that we find in the Torah are the wicked Nimrod and Esav. He says definitely not appropriate for Bnei Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. I mean, it says in the passage, V'rachamav al kol ma'asav, Hashem's mercy is upon all his creatures. So how could you go ahead and kill something just for the sake of passing the time? Just for the, you know, and the idea behind it, as the Ramban says in Chumash, is that the concept is that we should not become cruel, callous people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be good people. He wants to be compassionate people. If we are able to show compassion to inferior creatures, to creatures beneath us, like animals, if we're able to recognize that they also can suffer pain, emotional and physical, then we'll be better people. For instance, even basar v'chalav, not having meat and milk together, is understood by numerous mefarshim as actually an aspect of the idea of cruelty and callousness. This is actually the view of the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra. The Ramban and the Ibn Ezra, the Ramban's on Devarim Yud Dalad Chaf Aleph, and the Ibn Ezra is on Shmois Chaf Gimel Yud Tes. Where what they say is, regarding the idea of the Isser, of the prohibition of meat and milk, they say it's a reminder that, you see, milk is the substance which the mother bestows upon its child to give it life. So milk symbolizes chesed and kindness and life. In fact, in English, we use the term the milk of human kindness. We used to, anyway. It's not used much anymore. But the milk of human kindness. I think Shakespeare originated that, I remember. But So that's what milk symbolizes. But, you know, and to milk an animal requires that it be alive. So milk is something which nourishes and which can be obtained only from a living animal. You look at something like meat, though. Meat requires the death of an animal. So basically, it's not mixing milk and meat is a reminder to us of where they come from. It's a reminder saying, you know what, keep in mind that an animal died to produce this meat. Milk is an animal has to live to produce milk. Don't mix these two things, because it's type of like a little callous, as the Ramban puts it. It's achzarius he believe. There's a little bit of callousness in the heart to take milk, which symbolizes the life-giving substance the mother gives to her child, and to cook that with something that requires the death of an animal is ignoring where these things come from. It's almost like, I hesitate to use this example, but there is, I think it's in Orange County, California, which is like liberal central, where they have some type of, someone proposed a rule that if you wear fur there has to be a label inside the fur that tells you how the animal was killed to produce that fur. But it's an interesting idea, and I actually can sympathize with it a bit, but which is, it's like, you know, okay, you want to use the fur, fine, but just keep in mind where it came from. So that's, I think, what the Torah is telling us a little bit here as well. You want to have meat? Fine. You want to have milk? Fine. Keep in mind where they come from. So one of the ways that we keep in mind where they come from is through the separation of meat and milk. There are the Mefarshim who say that it's very similar to, it's symbolically like you're destroying the you're destroying a species because you're killing the offspring and the mother. So it's like, you know, there's a prohibition in the Torah to kill the mother and the offspring on the same day. Or, for example, to take a mother bird and her eggs simultaneously. What's the idea behind these? Because if I take the mother and leave the eggs can hatch and produce more birds. If I take the eggs and I leave the mother can lay more eggs. If I slaughter the mother, then the child can grow. If I slaughter the child, the mother can have more children. But if you take both simultaneously, what you're doing is an act of tantamount to destroying a species. That line is being cut off and erased from the world. You know, I'm killing the mother, the producer, and the produce. Right? So eating the milk together is symbolic of that idea that I'm taking the tree and the fruit and destroying them both simultaneously. And so there's also, taking too much liberty here, but it's also a matter of what we're doing also is it's a little bit of callousness. It's a callous disregard of where this came from. So it's interesting. Most people don't think of it that way, but there are many Mefarshim who do look at the Isra of Bosser, meat and milk, and Shchita, etc., as all being related to the same idea, which is the idea of Rachmanis, the idea of compassion, and inculcating within us ideas of compassion. Now, some of the mitzvahs of that regard to eating food and kashrus are actually relevant in the land of Israel, in Eretz Yisrael, like the mitzvahs of Truma and Maaser and Bikurim, etc. But I think those also play an important part in character development. In other words, until I have taken from my crop, which I work, I planted, I plowed, I planted, I harvested, I threshed, I winnowed, I did the whole works. I worked, you know, farmers work incredibly hard, right? But once I've done that, my food, my crop is still not kosher. Until the point that I've taken off a certain percentage and set it aside for the Kohen, who works in the Beit HaMikdash and that teaches the Jews. I've set aside some for the Levi, who does the same. I've set aside some for the poor. I've set aside some for the people in Yerushalayim who host the whole Jewish people three times a year and all the yeshiva and seminary students, etc. In other words, my crop is not kosher until I've given of it to those who are needy, to those who need that. That's an amazing lesson, because what that teaches us is, you know, a person might think that giving charity, giving tzedakah, is going above and beyond. I'm just that martyr Christian of you, as they say in the South. You know, it's like you're doing this act of charity, you're like, I'm an exceptionally good person. But what this is telling us, what these halachas tell us is you're nothing special. What you're doing is simple justice. What's the proof? That my crop is prohibited to me until I share it with others. I'm not being extra nice. I'm just fulfilling the obligation of justice. I'm fulfilling justice. Gratitude, bikurim, the idea that when I give the first fruits, which of course, I've never done this, but my guess is if you've grown fruit, etc., the first stuff that comes out is really precious to you, and you take great pride in it. The fact that you're able to take that and take it to the Beis HaMikdash and give it to the temple, or to the Kohen, is an expression of gratitude to Hashem in a very, very major way. So that's the idea of the character modification ideas. Number two, and this is extremely important, is the national unity aspect of kashrus. What I mean by that is that the Jewish people are a tiny, tiny group of Jews, tiny group of people in a huge, massive humanity. I mean, we're a tiny percentage, but we have a mission in the world. And because we have a mission, we have to maintain our separatedness. It's important for the Jews to have a group cohesiveness and also to have a separation from the rest of the world. I know it sounds harsh, but if we don't want to get lost and just disappear into the sea of humanity, the Jewish people have to take precautions to maintain their identity. And the truth is, any ethnic group throughout the world have always recognized that if they go somewhere, you know, people do this. You know, they try to keep their same cuisine. They try to go to frequent the Italian restaurant or frequent the French restaurant or frequently whatever, you know, whatever country they're from. And there's a great wisdom to that. So what it does is it contributes to our survival as a distinct nation. So you know what? It doesn't matter where I go to eat, right? If I go to any city, right, I look for a kosher restaurant. That's where I'm going to meet Jews. You know, we shop at the same bakeries. We go to the same butcher, right? We go to the same restaurants. There's a cohesiveness that is created by the ideas of kosher. You know, you go to places in Europe like Prague. You know, the Jewish community in Prague, they get subsidized meals, kosher meals at the Jewish community center. So, you know, if you go to the Jewish community center on a Shabbos, you'll meet a large percentage of the Prague Jewish community, which is a beautiful thing. You know, I remember my wife and I, we lived in Toronto for a number of years, and I was a rabbi there for 4 years. We decided to, we went back once for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and so we wanted to meet as many people as possible, schmooze with them. So what we decided to do, as my wife's suggestion, was hang out at the kosher supermarket the day before, like on the day before Rosh Hashanah, Erev Rosh Hashanah. So we figured, you know, we'll probably end up meeting most of the community. So, you know, we bought the kids treats, we hung out at the supermarket, we ended up meeting 80% of the community, at least the ladies, right? And we were able to see a lot of people. But there's a beautiful aspect to that. It also means, by the way, that it specifically separates us, because you see, if I can invite a non-Jew to my house and they can certainly eat in my house, but it makes it a little more difficult if they can't reciprocate. You know, I can't go. It's a hassle to go to their house. What are they going to do? You know, get a kosher caterer, buy new dishes. It's a hassle. It definitely creates a social barrier, and that's something which we deliberately do, because not because we're racist, but because we have a job, we have a mission to do, right? And if we become just diluted and disappear, we won't be able to do that job. So therefore, maintaining our social distinctiveness, maintaining our group cohesion is extremely important, and it's a way that we identify with each other, it's a way that we cling to each other, and it's a way we meet other Jews as well, and we have this common dietary patterns and a social barrier against assimilation. I would say also that a certain aspect of kashrus, no doubt, is the discouragement of pagan practices. This is how the Rambam puts it, he holds that a lot of the Torah, if not most, is about that, but certainly, the pagans used to do certain things, like they would deliberately drink the blood of an animal. Why did they drink the blood of an animal? Because they believed that they were absorbing the life force of the animal by drinking its blood. The Torah goes out of its way, I think it's five times, to tell us don't drink blood, don't have the blood. In fact, according to customs, as we know, when we have meat, you have to remove the blood, as much blood as is possible to remove. You have to try to remove. We do it by rinsing, salting, and then soaking, or soaking, salting, and then rinsing, and to remove the blood, or by grilling it to remove the blood. But the idea is, what we're saying is, you know, as the verse says in Devarim, it says, "Lo al halechem levaru yichyeh ha'adam." The person doesn't live by bread alone. I call mitzvah pi Hashem, that we live by that which Hashem gives us from His mouth. Meaning that I don't need to absorb the life force of the animal. Right, I'm eating this because I need the protein, I need the carbohydrates, I need the vitamins, etc., in order to survive. But ultimately, life doesn't come from there. Life comes as a gift from God. And so I guess to discourage that pagan practice, the Torah prohibits the drinking of blood. The Torah, for example, some maintain, refer from the Rambam, that actually the prohibition against mixing things together, like kilayim, like planting vineyard and wheat together in the same place is prohibited. Mixing meat and milk, crossbreeding animals. One of the ideas behind all of those is the concept that this is how Rav Hirsch understands it, is that the pagans wanted to show that there's no such thing as, there's no boundaries, there's no rules, there's no laws. So you know what? Even something like as natural as a species, they say we can subvert that, we can corrupt that. we can mix species. Even something as natural as each plant and each species being separate, liminor, as it says in Boratius, each one to its species, we can subvert that and we can change that and blur the distinctions. So the Torah, what the Torah wants to emphasize to us is, no, there are boundaries, there are laws, there are distinctions, there is morality, and one of the ways we show that is in our, even in our eating habits. Also, the kosher, which animals are kosher, which are non-kosher, according to the Rambam and others, the animals that are chosen as kosher, according to many, are animals which specifically were worshipped by the pagans. In other words, what could be a greater annulment of pagan ideology than basically having a barbecue with something that they worship? I mean, you couldn't get more than that. In fact, various mafashim point out that that's one of the ideas behind everyone there, by the way? I just want to meet, because I can't hear anything, so I'm hoping everyone's listening. Can people hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, good, excellent. Okay, I'm just talking here. I can't see anyone, and so I just got the terrible thought that I've been just talking for half an hour, and there's actually no one out there. Okay, all right, fine. Like if you give a shear and no one's listening, did you actually give a shear? Okay, fine. Anyway, so the idea being that let's say the Korban Pesach, you know, when we were in Egypt, so the Jewish people, not only were we physically enslaved to the Egyptians, but we were ideologically enslaved to the Egyptians as well. And we believed in their pagan gods, we believed in their idolatry, etc., etc. And so what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he told us to do the following. Before we get out of Egypt, he says, I want you to take an animal, which is actually was one of the animals the Egyptians held to be holy. They had the ram god Khnum, and so when we would take the lamb and, you know, slaughter it. And Hashem says not only slaughter it, but you have to roast it whole on a spit, barbecue it. What's the idea behind it? The idea is that these Egyptians are going to walk along and they're going to smell this lamb barbecuing, and they're going to say, that smells awesome. They're going to look over the fence in the Goldberg's house, and they're going to see this lamb, which you're supposed to barbecue whole on a spit, and they're looking and say, oh my God, right there on the barbecue, right? And, you know, it's offensive to them, but that's the purpose. The purpose is for the Jews to break out of their slave mentality, to break out of their belief in pagan superstitions, and there's no better way to do it than actually taking what they believe is a god, slaughtering it, roasting it, and eating it. And so actually, Rambam says that many of the animals which are kosher are animals which were worshipped by pagans. And when we eat them, what we're really saying is, guess what, folks? It is not an animal. It's a goat. It's a sheep. It's not a god. It's a goat. It's not divine. It's a cow. Right? That's it. Right? And yeah, it's living, but it didn't create the universe. It doesn't have the god Brahman incarnate within it. It doesn't have Khnum incarnate. It is basically a sheep. There's other aspects of kashrus, which I would say is the one of them is the historical symbolism. There are various aspects of kashrus which are historic symbolism. For example, the most famous example of that is the prohibition against eating the sciatic nerve or the gid hanasha. We know that Yaakov was fought with an angel. Traditionally, the Talmud tells us it was the angel of Esau, his brother, but his enemy. And he fights with the angel. The angel touches him in the sciatic nerve and causes him tremendous pain, and he limps throughout the night. And so we're not allowed to eat the sciatic nerve. So it's interesting, the Sefer HaChinuch says the idea of that is that it symbolizes that anti-Semites have continuously made us limp. In other words, they've tried to cripple us, whether it was by putting us in ghettos, whether it was by exiling us. Whenever we settle down, we get exiled, whether it was through pogroms, whether it was through limitations of what professions we could be in, where we could live, how we could walk, whether we could carry weapons, ride a horse, etc., etc., etc. Massive taxation. There's a continuous attempt to cripple us and to make us limp and to touch us. So the reminder of that is that we don't eat. That sciatic nerve that was touched in Jacob is, so to speak, the symbol of what the anti-Semites have tried to do to us throughout the centuries, and that we know that that will eventually be cured, that limp will be cured when dawn comes, meaning when the redemption is here. And so the refraining from eating that is reminding us of that fact, the fact that we have people have tried to cripple us, people we've been limping, but eventually dawn will come and we will stop and we will have a complete redemption. So it's at the Sefer Chinuch understands. There's a tremendous historic symbolism there. Also, when we talk about, for instance, the prohibition against certain fats in the animal, like chalev, or the blood of the animal, one of the ideas there is that those were the things that were generally were given for the korbanot, for the sacrifices, right? So they were given for the sacrifices. That means it's a way of saying, you know what, that part is dedicated to God. That's not something that I want to benefit from. In other words, it was exclusively devoted to the sacrifices in the temple, and it's not something which I should use. So it's a way of saying that, you know what, there's always parts of the world or aspects of everything, not everything is mine. I have to recognize that ultimately I should dedicate certain things to Hashem. You know, like we take some challah from the dough. When we take a piece of dough from the dough that we're making, and we basically take a part of it and dedicate it to the Kohanim. We can sign to the temple, we go to the Kohanim. Nowadays we burn it. But it's a way of saying that the world is not here just like my personal pleasure boat. The world is not here as like, you know, that it's my slave. Ultimately, I'm here to make the world a better place, to make myself a better place, and so to dedicate part of that to elevation, etc. That's what challah is. That's what certain aspects of the not eating the chalev, not eating the blood. Another important point, I would say, is the aesthetic sensitivity. The Torah wants us to have a certain aesthetic sensitivity. In other words, don't eat a carcass. I mean, the truth is, before refrigeration and before modern science, in Europe and in many countries, it was not uncommon to eat carrion, to eat a carcass, an animal that had died up by itself, or to eat diseased animals or something that are rotten. There are societies where people eat insects, people eat worms, people eat witchetty grubs. So the Torah wants us, Torah tells us don't eat those things. Don't eat a carcass, don't eat a diseased animal, don't eat worms, don't eat bugs. I think one of the ideas behind it is to instill in us a sense of dignity. Because dignity is important for morality. If I don't have any sense of my own dignity, if I have no sense of self-respect, then what's to stop me from doing something wrong? Right? In other words, when I have a sense of self-respect and dignity, I can say certain things are beneath me. It's beneath me. I wouldn't do it. And in fact, the Baal HaMa'or, Rav Zrachya Halevi, in his commentary to the Talmud, in the very introduction to his commentary on the Gemara, he mentions that HaNefesh Nikreis Kavod. One of the names for the soul is Kavod, or honor. Right? In other words, the soul of the human being is actually called Kavod, honor. What does he mean by that? And I think what he means is that the fact that we feel dignity, the fact that we feel honor, is an expression of our soul. The fact that we have this concept of self-esteem, of honor, etc., that's an expression of the fact that we have a neshama, we have a soul, a nefesh nikreis kavod. That's how Zrachya Halevi puts it. And so Moshe Shapiro explains that the primary feelings that we have of obligation, of morality, etc., is that they actually stem from that feeling of inner kavod. Right? In other words, I made a promise to someone, so I how can I renege on that? That's a matter of dignity. It's beneath my dignity to renege on a promise. So therefore, the idea of cultivating a sense of dignity and cultivating a sense of self-esteem by not eating things which are disgusting, by not eating the animals that died of natural causes, injured, disease, loathsome insects, foods, etc., that is really to increase and encourage the feeling that we have of a sense of dignity, which is, it's not ego. That's an important thing, to have a sense of dignity. That's another aspect. There is also, on a mystical level, and the Kabbalists all talk about the idea that, and in the Gemara talks about that non-kosher food is metamtem es halev. That means it confuses the heart. We don't actually understand this, but we know that the Torah tells us that the non-kosher food actually desensitizes us to spirituality. So that in the same way, we do know, for example, to give a simple example, there are foods that we know that can affect behavior. Drugs, alcohol, and various types of food can affect our emotion, can affect our behavior, can affect our perceptions, can have the effects on our personality. So we believe not only is it true of drugs and alcohol and various, but it's true of every food can have some level of impact spiritually on our personality, on our soul, etc. And the non-kosher foods, in a sense, what we say, you are what you eat. So that the non-kosher foods are rejected because there are characteristics of them that have an impact on our soul. To give an example, Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch says that the kosher animals, first of all, are not predatory animals that hunt and kill things. They're usually calm, domesticated animals, or domesticatable animals, which don't really hunt. They're not vicious, etc. Because those are traits that we don't want to inculcate into ourselves. They are generally animals that can be tamed. Again, why? Because the inner animal of the human being has to be tamed. They're not animals that are not active at all, like for example, the bottom dwellers, like mollusks, the oysters, etc. Right? Spineless sea creatures. But these are animals we also don't want to imitate because the person has to have, like a spine, the person has to have the ability to go against the flow, the person has to have self-control, etc. So there are traits in those animals that if we eat them on a mystical level, they actually can have an impact on our soul, the tumtum wave, and they can actually desensitize us to spirituality. There could be also some health effects of kashrus. Certainly the fact that we don't eat scavengers, the fact that we don't eat carnivores, the fact that we don't eat carcasses, the fact that we don't eat diseased animals, etc., certainly may have contributed. It is told, historians maintain, that the Jews suffered less under the various Black Plague in Europe and other plagues because of the fact that we had a separate food supply. We were very careful about washing and rinsing and washing and salting the meat. We were careful about washing our hands before we eat, etc. So we maintained a certain level of hygiene and health, which helped to perhaps decontaminate things and to help kept us away from the disease that ravaged the general population. I would say, finally, one important aspect of kashrus, I think we're supposed to finish around now, but one important aspect of kashrus also is that there are two extremes. There are some religions, generally the pagan religions, that basically wallow in the physical world. They see the human being as an animal, and just roll in the mud, and there's no hope of becoming anything beyond that. That's what a human is. Not really a religion. It's more of like a materialistic view, which is that you are basically an animal, and so why hold back? Why hold back? The other extreme is those religions that claim that you cannot be holy unless you withdraw from the physical world, that the physical world is evil and dirty and impure, and the only way to achieve holiness is by asceticism, celibate, be celibate, etc. In other words, withdraw from the physical world. So we say that neither of those things are correct. The Torah says that the world is not evil and dirty. The world is morally neutral. And it says that the human being is not an animal, but is beyond that. And so, therefore, what the Torah says is you can take the physical world and elevate it and make it kadosh, make it holy. So one of the things we do, what kashrus does is it takes something mundane and simple and instinctive like food and like eating, and it elevates it to a level of kedusha through all the halachas, all the laws, and all the care and the mindfulness we have in the laws of kashrus. That's a little bit of a introduction to the laws of kashrus. It is a chapter in my book, Gateway to Judaism. If anyone wants to see this class in written form, it's there. with all the Makoros, all the sources also there. But that's it. The rest is commentary. Go and learn. And I would also recommend an excellent book. I think it might be out of print. It's called The Royal Table by Jacob Cohn, C-O-H-N, The Royal Table. Phenomenal, phenomenal book about the ideas behind Kashrus. And also a classic, which is Dayan Grunfield, G-R-U-N-F-I-E-L-D, Dayan Grunfield's book on the kosher laws, which is two volumes and published by Sonsino. So those are three sources you could look at. The Royal Table by Jacob Cohn, The Laws of Kashrus by Dayan Grunfield, and my book, Gateway to Judaism, the chapter about Kashrut. Okay, I'm signing off, and thank you, everyone, for listening. And we will hopefully see you at further classes. Kol tov.